Simon, it has been such a long time since we sat down to do a long episode.
I know, I've surely missed it. So much has happened over these months. How are we doing, Sadashma?
We're doing pretty fine. Well, to start, we are no longer students. We are both done with our masters, right, Simon?
Sadashma, unofficially for now, but it will be official once I put on my cap and gown next month.
Well, congratulations are in order, nevertheless. I am so excited to navigate our anthropos journey as working professionals.
I agree. Congratulations to our artist Iman for starting his master's program in Singapore. We are so proud of you and look forward to seeing all the new ways you incorporate your art into our podcast.
Exactly. And you might have observed this in our Instagram already. If you have not, check out our Instagram and please do follow us.
And to our lovely listeners and supporters, we have truly missed you. And because we've missed you so much, we're going to release two episodes per month. Our first episode will be short and somewhat of a preview of our second episode.
So for our first episode, we will be targeting academic jargon, current climate affairs, discussing relevant books, movie series, or podcasts.
For instance, our previous episode focused on the Pakistan floods, and for today's episode, we will be talking about flood risk management. Connect the dots.
If not, we highly recommend you to listen to episode 2.3 Pakistan Floods before listening to this one. It's a very short episode, and we're sure that you'll like it.
Anyway, I'm Simone.
I'm Satashma.
And welcome back to Anthropause.
Season 2, Episode 4, Flood Risk Management.
On today's episode, we have two experts from the World Resources Institute joining us all the way from Mumbai, Karthiki Naik and Sahil Kinnekar.
Karthiki Naik is the program manager with the urban development team under the Sustainable Cities and Transport Program. She focuses on improving urban flood management in light of climate change impacts. Trained as a civil and an environmental engineer, she uses her experience as an engineer, policymaker, and a researcher to work towards improving urban water resilience. Her professional experience spans across the United States, Denmark, Brazil, and India.
Sahil Kinnekar is a member of the Water Youth Network and the Senior Program Associate, also with the Urban Development and Resilience Team under the Sustainable Cities and Transport Program. With his background in architecture and urbanism, Sahil's work focuses around environmental and infrastructural development, including green blue infrastructure, nature-based solutions towards flood risk management, and strategic planning for long-term climate resilience. Prior to working in Mumbai, Sahil has worked on both the Dutch and Bangladesh Delta plans.
Welcome to the show, Karthiki and Sahil. We are very excited to have this conversation today.
I personally have not stopped telling Sebastian how excited I am about this episode today because for my master's thesis, this is what I worked on. And I feel like there's so much to learn from you guys today. So I'm so excited.
Yes, I have been hearing about this for months, so I'm very happy that this is finally happening and we've got you too. So let's start this episode. So to get right into it, we have seen an increased frequency and intensity of flooding events around the world. So how have flooding patterns changed in Mumbai over the years?
So, very broadly, I think, let me point to the fact that we had a massive thunderstorm yesterday. So we are not supposed to have those anymore in October. The official monsoon season, which the stormwater drainage department and the hydrology department is also functioning by, is from June to September. And from the past few years, we've been seeing a lot of rain in October. So it has been expanding. That's one. So that means we have to plan for off season, which is not so much off season anymore. And these are pretty intense storms. So we have started to see a lot of intense rain in a short duration in Mumbai, which is creating an issue. To add to that, we typically didn't have cyclonic activity in the Arabian Sea that frequently, but we have had that over the past few years, which has caused damage. And we weren't in the eye of the cyclone, so we missed it, but we still saw a lot of rain again prior to monsoon, so in an off season.
Right, just to add to that, so the it's like you have these wet days with, as Karthike mentioned, intense rainfall in a really short span. At the same time, when in the monsoon spell, there are dry spells, longer dry spells as well because of that. So that's creating a very tricky situation. So if it's a 4 months of monsoon expected, out of that, let's say maybe it's 10, 12 days when you experience really heavy rainfall, and rest of the days is really dry, and that's like the huge volume that you have to take care of in really short span.
Yeah, I feel like we've been hearing this a lot. So you both know we're both from Nepal, and Nepal's like monsoon season has also like, I mean, it's off season now, but yet like they're noticing these monsoon patterns, which is extremely abnormal. We also, grew up in nations where monsoon season is a thing. Apparently, it is not a thing in many parts of the world. But what's interesting is that despite growing up with monsoon season, I feel like me personally, and maybe Simon too, like we grew up with this idea that high rainfall is the main reason for flooding. But it is only like partially true. And thanks to Simon and her thesis, I feel like she's kind of an expert now. But I found out that that's not the only reason, and there are other underlying factors responsible for flooding in cities. So, could you briefly explain what these other factors are?
So yeah, like one, what we just discussed, the climate patterns are one aspect to it. The other thing that we have been experiencing, and even in our practice we have been trying to stress on, is the kind of urbanization that is happening. So interestingly, let's take the example of Mumbai. In 2005, when it experienced the heavy rainfall, there was this Chitral Committee report that had come out, and in that report, they had extensively studied the event, and they expressed that the city used to have the runoff coefficient of 0.5, and the drainage design was as per runoff coefficient 5, and a rainfall event that might be for 25 mm per hour sort of a situation. But now, with the urbanization rate, that runoff coefficient has almost reached to 1, as equal to as 1. Which is literally a situation where your entire city is ground sealed. So there is no way for it to percolate. That is point one. And with your increasing intensity of rainfall, it has reached to almost like 100 mm for an hour, being like a usual situation now most of the times. So your infrastructure is not designed for 100, it is maximum maybe for 50 mm. And you're ground sealing at the same time. So there's no way for your water to go anywhere, but other than that, you just drain it to the sea. And on top of that, the geographic location of the city, being a coastal city, all the outfalls that are there, most of the outfalls are below sea level. There are hardly 6 to 7 outfalls that are above high tide level. So when there's a combination of high tide and heavy rainfall event, it's a compounded issue. And the urbanization is now adding into it, where your increasing infrastructure, like increasing the capacity of the infrastructure, becomes a big challenge in that case.
And like Mumbai, cities in India and cities across the global south, they have their own set of challenges, right? And we can see different types of flooding in these. There is these short bursts of rainfall that we see. Plus, we are a coastal city, as Sahil mentioned, so it comes with its own challenges, given that we are at sea level. But there are different types of flooding, right? So, for example, we see in the north, in Uttarakhand, where there is a lot of glacial melt happening because of climate change. And cities that are built in the valleys, they experience very heavy riverine flooding, which had not been happening in the past. So, spring melts have been quicker, it has exposed a lot more population to these kind of flooding events. So, and in the Sundarbans in on the east, you see a different kind of flooding. So there are a lot more cyclones happening there. So that is always the cause for flooding. Sometimes cities see flooding even with moderate rainfall. So the Bangalore example has been such a case where it was just as we talked about development, it was just a case of developing your city in the wrong places.
Yeah, thank you for your answers. And I think adding up to what like Karthik, you were saying, that's something similar that we saw in Pakistan as well, like a few months ago, with like all these different kinds of flooding acting all at once, and it was like a compounding effect. But now changing a direction a little and talking about flood management adaptation has been changing, and but the main goal has always been to achieve flood resilience. So how would you actually define flood resilience or a flood resilient city?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it would be very context specific, first of all, right? Because the context one would come with different kind of hazards that are there. Like just we mentioned, it might be precipitation, it might be riverine, it might be coastal, it might be combination of a lot of these things. And the second is the context in terms of the geography, topography, and the socioeconomic aspect, like the vulnerability of the area. How much population is actually exposed to that risk when the event happens. And combination of all of these things would lead to that flood resilient aspect. However, that would still won't be a target per se, right? It's a process. It's an evolving thing. I mean, I'm not sure when we can say that, okay, this city is a flood resilient city, unless it actually experiences a flood again, then. Sort of a thing. So it's an evolving process in a way, I would say.
I think it's high time we stop looking at flood resilience as draining cities that we typically see them as. So, oh, let's build these giant holding tanks and let's build channels and let's channelize our rivers, which will just drain the city. You're relying on a very dangerous assumption here that you are going to be able to drain that much water from the city effectively, especially in a context like Mumbai. So once you stop looking at flood resilience as draining the city and start looking at it as stormwater management, it not only talks about flood resilience, but also talks about this overlapping sector, which is water resilience. So weirdly, Chennai experiences flooding, and at the same time, in dry seasons, it experiences droughts. What's that about? So, why aren't we developing infrastructure or planning the city right such that we can actually overlap these sectors and plan accordingly? And it is a process. So, it cannot be a siloed approach where you just build infrastructure and you engineer your way out of the problem. I'm an engineer, but you cannot just rely on gray infrastructure to channel out that water. Flood resilience overlaps a lot of sectors. In the Mumbai context, especially, we have four rivers running through the city, and those rivers are really stressed. They need proper solid waste management. They need proper sewage management. And typically, we don't think, or the governance doesn't think about flood management with respect to those sectors, which we need to start thinking about.
Thank you so much for your answer. And for our listeners, gray infrastructures are basically hardcore engineered traditional structures like seawalls and dikes and things like that. And I think we'll be getting into that later in our episode. We have some questions about gray and green infrastructure as well. But I really want to talk a little more about flood adaptation strategies that have already been implemented in Mumbai. Are there like a good balance of gray infrastructures and green infrastructures? Could you elaborate a little?
Well, in terms of Mumbai, it is to be honest, it's a heavily engineered approach. Largely, we can say there are three approaches that are taken. One is diverting the water, like wherever it is flooded, you divert it into a different drainage network system, which is less stressed, and you re reduce the stress of the system where it is flooded. The second is you install makeshift mini pumps over there, localized solutions, and then you pump out that water into a nearby water body or a canal or a river or a nala for that matter. And then the third approach is sort of a combination where you use a pump and you use a holding tank approach. And I recently in the news, there has been this Hindmata holding tank, which takes up most of the area that used to flood a lot in till last year, I believe. And this year, it has been a success story. But interestingly, the rainfall hasn't been that intense this year to actually test that infrastructure. So largely, these are the approaches. And then along the coastline, we have this pumping stations because most of the outfalls are submerged. They use these floodgates and pumping stations to pump out the water. So that's the approach largely, I would say.
Typically, I mentioned four rivers and there's also a creek, and those are the drainage pathways of the city. Typically, the Stormwater Drainage Department has an all-round desilting program for at least one of the main rivers and the rest sometimes. And that's another flood control measure. The other flood control measure is building retaining walls along these rivers, and we have covered this in our photo essay, especially on the Mithi River. But it does raise the question. They work really hard. The Stormwater Drainage Department works really hard in the monsoon to make sure that there are no liabilities and the flooding issue is resolved. But then do we need a more holistic approach? Do we need to rethink certain engineering measures as flooding measures only? Or do we need to think about planning as the main problem that causes flooding?
One of my closest friends, she's from Mumbai, and she keeps telling me about the rainwater harvesting program that you guys have. And she tends to talk in a way that she says it's very successful. So I really wanted to hear a little about rainwater harvesting and how it's done and how it really helps that. I guess it helps that what you were talking about, Sahil, before, like the dry season and then the wet season. Like, I think she was like, it really helps during that time. So I really want to hear from you guys. What is this rainwater harvesting in Mumbai?
So, I'm not sure about it being a successful model. It maybe at individual levels within the housing societies, whoever have taken up that particular approach, because they are very active in that sort of a system and they are maintaining it and operating it, it is working to their end. And that is definitely one of the ways, right? Like, just imagine on your land parcel, whenever there's a rainfall, and whatever water is there, if you're able to catch that water, you're reducing the stress on the city infrastructure, which is on the street. And then you're able to use that throughout the year or at least during that monsoon time. So in that sense, definitely it might be a useful thing. But yeah, it is a tricky thing in terms of its execution per se. To make it mandatory also in that sense. So that is a bit tricky, I would say.
So we are not yet ready to let go of this topic of resilience. We have one more question on it. So community resilience has, of course, like become an important factor in flood risk management and in generally in like climate change adaptation. So just for our listeners' understanding, Kristen Magus in 2010 defined community resilience as the existence, development, and engagement of community resources by community members to thrive in an environment characterized by change, certainty, unpredictability, and surprise. So, however, like now in recent years, resilience is a term that is being overused to describe vulnerable communities. So, for instance, like reports and articles have often described Bangladesh as a resilient force against climate change. So, Karthiki and Sahil, do you think that this term, irrespective of how it started, is being used to hide the inequities and inadequacies in climate change adaptation?
So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting one, especially talking from the experiences in Mumbai. And then I'll come to another examples as well, or Karthik can also add to that. Most of the time when there's a flooding situation in case of Mumbai, before the disaster management department actually is deployed, it is observed that it is most of the time these community groups or religious societies or educational institutions that are there who open up their campuses, their resources for people during that event. And then it is sort of called as the social resilience aspect of the city, that it is able to take care of its own. The citizens are able to take care of their own in a way. That is very well observed in the city. However, then it becomes a little tricky, right? That then completely relying on it, is that the right way to go ahead? Shouldn't it be coming from both the sides? I mean, of course, citizens being the first responders, they have to have that sort of a capacity, training, understanding. But at the same time, it needs to also have as a system within the institution, within the state that is operating in that sense. Very interestingly, before this monsoon, this year's monsoon, we had this one session with most of the vulnerable communities within Mumbai who experienced landslide especially during rainfall events. And that was a very interesting take from the city government or city corporation, where they actually acknowledged that fact. And they decided that before monsoon, they'll go to the community, they'll sit with them, they'll try and understand what is their understanding of this landslide bit, and then try to build up their capacity in terms of what are the reasons of landslide and how they can prevent it. And then, of course, when the event happens, what they should be doing. Because most of the time they are in a hilly areas or in a really steep sloped areas, which becomes very tricky to deploy disaster measures swiftly in that sense.
But I want to say that Sahil used this word, which really struck me, that he mentioned that you shouldn't romanticize community resilience as a measure. Inequity and inadequacy. So inequity comes into play when, while planning for flood resilience, you do not involve or engage certain parts of the community or some citizens or some stakeholders. Automatically, you're marginalizing them. So if you assume that a community is resilient because they are good first responders, and do not include them in your flood resilience planning, you're automatically marginalizing them. So it is very important to look at flood resilience or base it on very sound scientific principles, development principles, and look at it through a socioeconomic lens. You cannot disconnect that aspect from this as social sciences, like a lot of people say. It is stakeholders. It's not social sciences. These are your stakeholders. And so then flood management becomes a much broader problem than what it's being envisioned as. And that creates that gap. So typically, engineers are the ones responding to floods. Disaster management is made up of engineers, rescuers, firefighters, and they do a great job. But then you are tasking them with this additional responsibility of making sure that they engage all stakeholders. They might not be trained for it. So in that case, then do we need to build capacity within our governments in the global south to make sure that this aspect is taken care of?
So just to take that forward, there's a very interesting example in Mumbai's case, where to the east side of Mumbai, where you have this creek or the bay area that is there, there is this colony, which is a resettlement colony called as Cheetah Camp. A lot of these slum dwellers have been resettled over there because of maybe some project, infrastructure project or redevelopment projects that are happening. Now, interestingly, that entire land that is there is sort of a marshy wetland, definitely not where you would like to rehabilitate someone. So, if that's the plan, first maybe is the situation where you make that land ready for that kind of a development, right? Then the second thing is deploying infrastructure for that kind of population that would be living over there. So there's a deficiency of sewage network. There's only stormwater network that is, and because of no sewage network, most of the toilets, even the community ones or the individual household ones, are getting connected to the stormwater drainage lines, which get clogged, or that water comes into your natural water bodies because your drainage eventually gets discharged into those water bodies, right? Now the community is trying out their own measures to cope up with this situation. So let's say they are going for some sort of a decentralized systems, like having septic tanks below, which is a very interesting bit to see that those kind of communities are coming up with those solutions on their own. That you have a septic tank below your community toilet, so you are disconnecting from the stormwater drainage, in spite you don't have a sewage network. But now, interestingly, because it was a marshy land, the groundwater table is quite high. Now that is kind of pushing the septic tank and the water inside the toilet block from the ground. So that is now creating another issue in that sense. So if all of this was thought about, so not only treating this as a technical or a design and planning exercise, but also socio-economic issue, makes it a holistic way of approaching the flooding issue on, and even resettling people within certain areas.
I might be getting ahead with this follow-up question, but so, you know, community engagement, getting a lot of more community involved and maybe like designing or implementing or just discussing these flood management issues might is important. But do you think when we look at flood management through nature-based solution, it may promote more community engagements? Do you think that's the case?
That's a tricky one. We have to be careful with what we adopt, right? So nature-based solutions, there are always these trends in the environmental world where you have these buzzwords and they just you know it just encompasses a very narrow vision for those buzzwords, right? Water energy nexus was one, and now it's nature-based solutions. And nature-based solutions are being promoted a lot. But just because they are a buzzword, they should not be discounted. It's a very tricky situation. And like any solution, they are not a silver bullet. In terms of engagement, so the way I see nature-based solutions is sometimes nature-based solutions are just not intervening and letting nature be. For example, wetlands, right? Wetlands in Kolkata, which were treating wastewater before, and they have been preserved, but and there is a lot of community engagement in that. So typically, with nature-based solutions, the community does grow around a natural area, be it a water body, be it a wetland. Typically, just people are drawn to such areas and they grow around it. We do have an example of a deliberate intervention where we had such kind of engagement. So nature-based solutions, I mean, I don't want to just put them in a box and say, all right, they are a buzzword, let's not talk about them. But they definitely have their co-benefits, be it a intervention-based solution or just natural areas and their protection. They definitely have their co-benefits. They help decentralize, right? So if you have a flood management problem across the city, you're relying on grain infrastructure, your ground is getting sealed up because of development, you can chip away at that problem a little bit and add nature-based solutions throughout. Make developers reduce the runoff from their development. So you could do that. At the same time, you cannot blindly adapt these kind of solutions, right? So you cannot just look at it as this fancy way of beautifying an area. You have to take into consideration if they will operate well, if they can be maintained well. And that's where the community comes in. So once you have a nature-based solution installed, it is up to the community to take ownership of it. And why would they take ownership of it if they weren't involved in the process to begin with? So we have been working on this resettlement colony, and that is a pretty large colony of about 70 buildings, completely paved. They have this ground in the middle where children play, and it's completely concretized. And they want to change things. So they want it not to flood in the monsoons, and they want to be able to use it. And they want to make it prettier, if not for the lack of a better word. And going in as an NGO, as people, as environmentalists or designers or engineers, we have a certain vision for flood management, right? We could just create this Miyawaki forest there and, you know, let it be like, oh, wow, we created a forest there. But no, we cannot do that because we have, and Deepti Tarpade and Shruti Malivar from our team have worked on this extensively on the stakeholder engagement, where they talk through the designs, they talk through what they would like. So they want an area to be able to play. They want a garden. So it's very much based off the residents' vision, And it began as a greening project and turned into a flooding project. So it's a very evolving project, but there are concerns, right? There are gaps on how do we design it properly so that we actually reduce the flooding there. So that, you know, we don't rely on the stormwater drains to reduce the flooding there, which is, they are deficient there. How do we make sure that the citizens or the residents are sensitized so that they maintain it well? There is a solid waste issue there. So we are going to have to dive into that. So work across government departments for that. Make sure they have a system in place for that. So this, you know, expands to a much larger problem. Yeah, I would say it does need that community engagement component. I think grain infrastructure would also need that community component. An example I can think of is if you have storm drains and if they don't work, right, if you have blocked storm drains, the community component is where you actually protect those storm drains, have proper solid waste disposal, etc. So I think you cannot avoid that. You have to bring that in everywhere.
I think now this has really got me thinking. That was such a great explanation. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to the first part of episode 2.4. We had such an engaging conversation with Karthiki and Sahil, so we decided to split this episode into two parts.
The second part of this episode is already up, so please make sure to listen to that.